This is the third in a series that I'm titling A Journey on an Eagle's Back. And in the beginning, the first tape was titled Beginning the Spiral Dance. And to give you a brief overview, I invited people to join me stepping out with eagle vision, beginning by soaring into the past and naming and appreciating the diverse life that existed in pre-historical times, the pre-Columbian times. And then the second time we talked about making room for the circle. To begin a spiral dance, you have to sort of make a big space. And I brought out the some of the beginning of the story of the Pueblo people. And it's a making room by letting go of some things like linear thinking and letting go of and trying to get out of our normal orientation and look at things maybe in a different way. A spiral dance is a dance, and as you walk around the road today, you'll see me little. I've been drawing little sketches in the ground. Today I'm going to talk about another step in starting a spiral dance, and that's taking hands. And we sort of did that this morning by naming each other, by sharing, just the beginning of, you know, you form a circle and you start looking around and seeing and picking out some unique differences that, and we're making a circle. And then we begin to take hands, and I'm going to title this today on taking hands. And I'm going to focus on a particular group of Indians, the Huron and Iroquois people of the Great Lakes territory. So it's kind of interesting maybe to Lutherans with their Minnesota kind of heritage and everything. So I think we'll have fun with that. I see us doing a dance. I see this as a spiral. And so a spiral goes in all directions. And so I'm going to open then with a prayer to all directions. Can you stand? And face the east. There's so many things that we can think about when we face the east, but today, as we pray, I would like to think about the natural, the earth. We send out appreciation for this beautiful lake, for these hills, for the broad plateaus, the Columbia River that brings life to the whole of the region. We send out appreciation for the great northern forest that extends out to our left. We send out appreciation for the vast grass prairie land that exists in this direction, that feeds not only our country, but feeds people all over the world. We give thanks for the great range of Appalachians, the ancient root mountains of this land, the source of water and mineral and life, the great hardwood forests, the Atlantic Ocean, the rich fish life, the seafood, the beautiful beaches. We see the fjords and mountains and high heath of England and France and the mountains, and we just celebrate this beauty that exists in this direction. These ecologies that plants and animals and birds that we see as we look to the east and turn to the south. We celebrate the minerals, the stones, the rocks, the foundation for all of our material development, the stones that provided the building blocks of our great cities and houses, the metals that were mined out of the earth that we have turned into airplanes and jets and skyscrapers. We look to the south and we celebrate the life that is there. We celebrate the incredible chain of mountains and volcanoes that create that are continuing to create. We celebrate this great sea that is the source of our weather, our rain, our sun. We celebrate the land and the waters and the Arctic, the Antarctic frozen wasteland that balances our whole system. We celebrate the winds that whirl and carry us our life and return to the west. We celebrate the air, the birds, the creatures that fly, that lift our spirits up, that send our minds off and away and around. We celebrate those man-made things that fly, those satellites that taught us the vision of one planet, one beautiful blue marble floating in space, and brought to us the truth that this is the only place that we can live. And we celebrate our beautiful earth. We celebrate the wonderful sun that warms and keeps us, that feeds us and sustains us. We celebrate the gifts of the stars that light the night, the moon that controls not only just our waters, but our own bodies, our own ebb and flow of life. We celebrate our connection to the moon. We turn to the north. And we give thanks for the night, for the darkness, for the silence, for the quiet, for the secret things, the inner things, the mysteries of molecules and matter and energy and nuclear exchanges, for the incredible chemistry in our minds and in our bodies and in creation, the incredible unity of matter. As we look to this direction, we give thanks for that which created us, that which has given us life. And we face the east and we look within and we celebrate and give thanks for our own life. The fact that we exist, we marvel at the sequence of events that brought some of us from heritage that goes back to places all around the world. We marvel at the journeys that our humanity has taken that brings us here. And we celebrate our existence. Some of us have come out of a past of escape from dreadful tyranny. Some of us have come out of a past of escape from terrible oppression and poverty. Some of us have come out of a past of escape from religious and ideological persecution. And we celebrate, even in our own lack of needing to be aware of that history, that we have been able to just live and not really feel the pain that brought our ancestors to this land. We celebrate those of us who welcome others with open arms, who make room for strangers, who see the sacredness of all creation and know that any human walking on the face of the earth is a child of our Earth Mother and reaches out with love and connectedness. And we look up and we celebrate this moment, this brief moment when we, a representation of the whole universe, come together and experience each other. We celebrate time, the fact that 10 people who do not know each other and do not have common experiences, for some reason are brought together in this place, and our lives will never be the same for having touched. And for this we celebrate and give thanks. Amen. How's that for an eagle flight? I love it. I love it. I have been playing with this image. And the more I play with it, the more fun it is. And I invite you to do that. When you face a direction, send your mind out and see what you see. It's really fun. Taking hands together, forming a great circle. The ministry that I have is with the Lutheran Church in America, Pacific Northwest Synod, and the American Lutheran Church, North Pacific District, and the AELC in this area too. And my ministry is to the Lutheran Church to lift up the lives of the Indian people that are your neighbors. And in doing that, I hope to reach out to those people so that we can build relationships with them, so that we can do what we're doing in this room, seeing each other's faces, learning each other's names, and beginning to hear each other's stories, so that we celebrate the sacredness of life and experience the gift that God has given us in our diversity. And so, my first objective is to send you out from here willing and able and ready to make relationships with Indian people. I also would like to begin the process of education that hopefully will also meet the needs of those of you who have already worked to learn something about your Indian brothers and sisters. I see it as a dance, as a play. We spin around naming names, and the next time we come around, we see a little more, and we learn a little more, and we come around again, and we get deeper and deeper into the history and experience of the relationship between Indians and non-Indians. And then in the spiral, we spiral into the middle, taking hands and spiraling in, and then we turn around and then go back out again. And as we come through and look at it from another direction and another perspective, and that's the sort of form that's going to carry on through 15 sessions. It is my desire that this one session will be sufficient. If you can't make it to any others, you'll have at least some gift to take with you. I have to begin by admitting that I am a coward. And I really knew it yesterday when I did not really get into talking about the history of experience between the Pueblo and the Spanish missionaries. Some of this message that I have to share with people about Indians is You know, it's like the dark and light that we talk about in other contexts in our religious experience. There is the light, the energy, the life, the creativity, the diversity of the different Indian peoples. But there is the dark. There is on the one hand, the relationship, the development of interaction between those early settlers and those early people and Indian people. And there is a history of an ongoing history that records life and growth and celebration. But at the same time, there is this very painful and very dark side to the story. And I admit that I am a coward. With strangers, it's much easier to tell you, invite you to hear the stories that are the real positive ones. The negative side, the dark side, is not nearly as comfortable to talk about. And when you get into Indians, you soon touch that dark side, that pain, the story. And so, I don't know how brave I'll be in this. And one of the reasons I say that is because I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I really don't want people to go away from a study of Indians feeling guilty or feeling that you have been shoulded upon, as my pastor says, we stand there and should on each other. I prefer an image of taking hands in the spiral dance, of touching very, very lightly, of not really dragging one around or pulling each other around, but I visualize an experience where we touch each other very lightly, enough to be in contact and connected, enough to experience each other, but not in anything that drags down the individual or pulls the individual in a direction that they do not choose to go. And so as I try to develop this ministry, I'm trying to create images and ways of doing this that are very, very gentle and light. I don't think we'll get anywhere in relationship with Indian people if we do not look at the sad and terrible history that's there. On the other hand, if we only look at the sad and terrible history, we will not get anywhere. So, I would like us to just introduce that as a place where I'm at. It's a lot easier for me to celebrate the diversity than it is to talk about some of the hard things. So, climbing on an eagle's back, we fly to the Great Lakes area. And I would like you to open your ears and minds and hearts to a visualization of a peoples whose names today have come down to us as Huron and Iroquois. I have been trying to teach a concept in this class that the names are so important, and that even understanding the names and hearing the names again and lifting up the names is so important, because in this process of writing textbooks, in creating a mythology about what happened between Indians and non-Indians, one of the real ways to oppress a people is to mess with their names, to change their names, to rename them, to take away their name, to deny their name in one language, their own language, and translate it into another language. And many, many of you who have come out of a heritage where you immigrated know that to be true too, that one of the first steps in experience of bringing you into this country was someone messing with your name. And so to me it's very significant that we lift up the names of the peoples. And how do we find what's the true name? There are peoples in this area called the Tobacco people who lived north of Lake Erie. They were called the Tobacco. They called themselves, and I've never heard it spoken aloud, so it's P-E-T-U-N-S, Petuns. The Hurons, we have been taught the people who live north of Lake Ontario to be the Hurons. They call themselves, well, they didn't actually call themselves the Wendats, W-E-N-D-A-T-S. That was the French name that was given to them. Again, I haven't studied them enough to be able to name their own names. The Erie, the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondagas, the Oneidas, the Mohawk, the Mohicans. These are some of the names of people in the places that are associated with the Great Lakes. I want to name their names and celebrate their existence. They were there when the French came, and so I want to describe a little bit of their life. They lived in settlements, and they had about 1,000 people in a settlement. They were not nomadic. They had sort of semi-permanent villages, and they surrounded them with logs. The people lived in long houses, and they were approximately 36 feet wide. They covered them with bark, and it was a shared existence with cooking fires for maybe a dozen families existing inside the one longhouse. This is very significant as we talk about some of their spiritual life and their beliefs. They were farmers in the sense that they cultivated corn and sunflowers, beans and squash, tobacco. They would cut down the forest, burn the stumps, plant a crop, build, and that land would support them long enough for a certain period of time. Then they would go ahead and move to another. It was the men who did the clearing and the women who did the farming. They were Iroquois speaking, and they fed themselves by hunting. And so the animals were very important. The turtle, wolf, bear, beaver, deer, hawk, porcupine, and snake became the foundational clans. And the people were grouped together by the mother's name and by the mother's lineage. And so she would be, for example, of the bear clan. And then it would be incestuous for anybody within the bear clan to marry another within the bear clan. Okay. So they were separated out in this way. They had a lineage that went according to the heritage of the mother. They were very interesting in contrast to what we might be familiar with in terms of decision making. It was a sense of invitation and community building, but no one had the authority to enforce a regulation. In other words, they made decisions by way of consensus. They had like a council, but the council was more of a sounding board in which to discuss and throw ideas out and build consensus. But even after they had a consensus, any individual or any band, any clan, could do whatever they wanted to do. In other words, they had sort of almost a concept of majority rule, but the individual was not obligated to follow this this decision, whatever it was. So there was tremendous room for individual expression in the Huron people. Okay, there's so much information, it's really hard to just kind of distill it. They were traders. They were people who had concepts of property that were very significant. For example, property could be used to compensate for a death. Property could be used to resolve a conflict. A conflict could be resolved based on the exchange of property. And so acquiring property was very important to them. They were traders. But it was very different from our concept of acquiring property. You acquired property so that you could give it away. And the highest regard was someone who had a lot of property and who gave everything away. And also, if you had property, if you had some kind of a material thing, you could also give it to a sort of a community fund or community chest. The value of being prosperous was that your prosperity was a gift to the whole community. And this concept of whole community is so deep and so integrated into the Huron peoples that they have two incredible festivals associated with them. And the one is a day of dream fulfillment. And basically they had the ideas of this, that if you had a dream, you would keep your dreams. Your dreams were tremendously important in running your life. And they were so important that if I sat here and I said, I had a dream that I don't know what my dream might be. I had a dream that this room was filled with flowers. Then the people in the town, in the longhouse, in the group, would, on this particular one day, do anything to fulfill your dream, so that on the dream fulfilling day, this room would be filled with flowers. Another woman maybe would have a dream of experiencing her dead husband. Now, how could they fulfill that dream? Well, they had sacred people, shamans, who were very, very good at devising metaphysical substitutions for dreams that could not literally be worked out, so that they might collect some elements that were significant to this dead person and bring them together in a gift to this woman. Or he might shape a doll, or you know, a form that represents the lost person, and then that would be gifted to her on the dreaming fulfilling day, and all kinds of dreams. Incredible, exciting concept that builds community, because your role is to fill the dreams of your community, which is a fantastic concept. And how sacred is it that they were community? It's like this. If we took everybody who ever came to Holden Village, and when they died, we returned their bodies to Holden and buried them. But I can't remember just how many years it is. I think it's 15 years. We would dig up their bodies, and in a very sacred way, dig up their bodies, remember their names, name their names, remember their dreams, give them or create gifts, rich gifts that were of great value to the person who is dead. And then they would dig a pit about 15 feet, and I can't remember exactly how many feet it is, but it was the feast of the dead, and they would you can just visualize this incredible ceremony of bringing this bundle of bones and placing them in the pits and naming their name and gifting them with a beautiful gift. And so you have this pit full of all the people who have died in the last 15 years. And then in an incredible image, they take long poles and they stir the bones together and they mix them all together. And an incredible expression of our connectedness, because we'll be together after we die. We'll never be separated, you know. Then they create this pit. And I just blows me away. What a concept that is. And they also. Well, they were doing it when the French arrived. Whether it still goes on today, I would not speak for anybody to know exactly whether any of that continues. And I'll talk about that a little bit. They also had a traditional conflict with the Iroquois to the east. And generations of fighting going back and forth with them. And a tension, because there was... peace was a good idea. They were traders. They were people who traveled and moved, and they were hunters. And if you were at war with the Iroquois, then your hunting was endangered, your trade was endangered, your life was endangered. But when you had plenty of food, plenty of material goods, and things were looking pretty good, then they had the concept of war. And what you did is you went off and you attacked the Iroquois. And this will have great impact on where the Huron are today. I talked a little bit about the shaman. The shaman is not somebody who is ordained to do that work. They have a concept that the spiritual leader is just someone who does the things that are available to everyone, but they just do it a little bit better. And they were curing, healing the ill. And so the test of whether they were a real powerful shaman or not was whether or not the person that they tried to cure got well. But if they did, then this person, you know, became more and more powerful. So it was... your sacred leadership, your medicine leadership depended on whether or not people got better when you did the sacred ritual or you did what you did. So we have shamans, but we don't have shamans whose authority is locked in, right? I mean, if they can't make people well, they lose their ability to lead the people, to be leaders. Okay, so we have this pretty happy life, pretty calm life. They have a cosmology, a sense of being born. The story is, there's a lot of stories, and they're not real potent stories like in some other Indian tribes where the stories are the center of the existence. But they do tell some stories of creation about a woman who falls through a hole in the sky and... maybe she fell and maybe she was pushed by her angry husband, but one way or another she fell through the hole in the sky and a tortoise came up out of the sea. And so their vision of the earth is the back of a tortoise, where this earth, a creator mother, gave birth to the first two men. And that's kind of a story. And so the stories of these two men are kind of the teaching stories about how things got to be the way they got to be. So it's a you know, pretty fairly advanced civilization. A lot of people. I think there was a statement in here. 10% of all native peoples who lived north of Mexico lived in this area. That's a lot of people. 10% of all native people who lived north of Mexico lived in this region. And then comes. The part of the story that's hard for me to tell, the coming of the white man. the French. They began with explorers who were basically coming in for trading and looking for furs and that sort of stuff. The Franciscans followed, but they were not effective. The Franciscans depended on a European model, and they didn't really want to live with the Indians or convert the Indians. They just they were colonizers. They were not particularly effective, and I think it was only 7 years and they left, and they were replaced by the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. And the Jesuits came into the area of the Huron with coming out of a past. They were an internationally oriented group. They had a lot of experience going out to different lands, and they had a philosophy that was a little bit different, well, very different from the Franciscans and from the Spanish in the Pueblo area. Their philosophy was to go and live with the people and learn about them and understand what they are, and not try to change them in any great way, but just to gain their respect, learn their languages, and then share the gospel with the people. So when the Jesuits went to China, they wore the robes of the Mandarin sacred teacher, and then they began to share in that way. Well, when they went into the Huron, they studied the shaman and the warrior leader. They learned sacred symbols and sacred things. For example, they learned that red was a sacred color. So the Jesuits painted all their crosses red. So they got in there and they tried to find ways that they could communicate. They tried to learn what the culture of the Huron was and then relate to that something that they believed. They wanted conversion, they wanted baptism, but they didn't want to destroy the culture. They didn't have the concept that the Spanish had, that everything was evil and you had to just kill the Indian in order to save the soul. That sort of concept. And when you first read this, you think, well, that's good. They probably did better. But as I finished this chapter, I thought, you know, that may have been more destructive than the other. It's very interesting because the story of the Spanish interaction with the Pueblo survived virtually intact. When I read the story of the Jesuits' interaction with the Hurons and the people in this area, the Hurons were almost totally destroyed. It's really interesting. One of the reasons I'm using this particular book is because each different cultural group that came to work with the Indians had some basic assumptions. The Spanish had a basic assumption that everything that was Indian, that, you know, the Pueblo people, was evil, and if you could just stop doing everything that the Pueblo did and did all the things that the friars did in the mission, then that would be the answer. The Jesuits came and they said, we'll have the Indians not change a great deal, but we will teach them the gospel. And we will stop things like free and easy divorce and cannibalism. There was, in the celebration of warfare and power, they had, and this book says, out of a missionary activity, out of the Mesoamerican, Mexican, Mayan, Aztec group of people, some Aztec or Mayan missionary had come up and taught the Huron people cannibalism, a sacrifice of men to the sun, and the eating of their bodies to participate in that courage. And the Jesuits were horrified by that, and they didn't want anything to do with that. So there were some, you know, things that the Jesuits were determined to change, but like they didn't want to change the language, and they didn't want to change everything the way that the Spanish did. Okay.
What caused the downfall?
Okay.
The media.
What happened yesterday? What caused the downfall to the Pueblo? What weakened them so much?
Illness. All caused some of those diseases.
And that's the same thing that happened. The Jesuits came in, and with the Jesuits came illness. And in a very short period of time, half of the Huron people died. And the thing that was so destructive, one of the things that was so destructive, is that the Jesuits would not baptize anybody unless they really demonstrated a change, you know, they really adopted the faith, except unless they were dying, see? And then if they were dying, they would baptize them and celebrate their saved soul. So the Hurons looked at this ritual here. Here comes death in the form of disease. And at the very moment of death, here is a ritual of baptism. And here are these men in black robes celebrating. And their interpretation of this is that these men in black robes are bringing death. And then they were teaching, in contrast to this experience of mixing the bones, that if you weren't baptized when you died, if you didn't receive faith, you would go to a totally different place than the one who was baptized. And the Jesuits were teaching that people who were baptized would go after death to a wonderful place. And people who were not baptized would go after death to a horrible place. This was quite in contrast to the Huron teaching that everybody would go to a pleasant afterlife. That in this wonderful place with these wonderful gifts and the mixing of bones, we would be all together, we would have everything we need, and life after death would be good. The Jesuits came in and said, uh-uh. If you're not baptized, life after death is eternal fire. And eternal separation from your loved ones. And here were people that were incredibly connected to their loved ones. So there is evidence of a lot of baptisms that came about from a desire on the part of the Huron people to stay with their loved ones. So that we got a lot of conversions. The Jesuits got a lot of conversion because one particularly significant death would happen and all the people who were related to him would get baptized so that they would be with this person in death. A couple of quick thoughts about I've mentioned before to some of you who were here before about this business about graves and death and stuff. I am personally horrified at the thought of someone digging up these sacred sites, these graves. I personally feel that if you would like to be an advocate of Native peoples, that you would join me in opposing any digging up of sacred sites. If anyone is going to dig up the bones of a people, it should only be the sacred leaders of that people and nobody else, in my opinion. And a couple of interesting things about burying people. A little baby wouldn't be buried with this group, an infant. A little baby would be buried along the pathway somewhere, so that it could be born again. An interesting thought. An infant wouldn't be considered totally gone. Mm-hmm. It would be buried along the pathway and then it would come again in this kind of a sense. And a witch or someone who was considered outcast or a prisoner of war or someone that were not even buried, just cast off with the garbage. It was kind of interesting. Reflection of where they, what they have to tell. Oh. So what happens? The longhouses, the different strong Huron villages, were tremendously weakened, not only physically by disease, but spiritually and emotionally by the inability of the shamans, the sacred leader, to heal these sick people. So they're, if they couldn't heal, then they've lost their power and you don't follow them. So it's kind of a leaderless kind of a position. They're weakened by, well, you can guess what the next thing happens, is having baptized someone in, to be a Christian here on, then they begin to teach that the Christians will go to heaven and the non-Christians will go to hell. And then the Christians realize that they shouldn't mix up their bones. I mean, because they have this teaching about resurrection, the Christian Hurons decide that they cannot mix their bones with all these other people. And so you have here the most significant connecting experience of the Huron, the mixing of the bones, and the Christian Hurons, under the influence of the Jesuits, are told not to do that anymore. And so it's a tremendous breaking of the circle, tremendous destruction of the unity of the people. Okay. And then, remember what I said about their organization, where they had the they had some group cohesiveness, but they also had a real concept of individuality. Okay, and that meant that they didn't really function really well together as a great confederacy in the same sense that the Iroquois did, and this turns out to be very deadly. The Iroquois attack, an all-out confederated attack, a war. And you can guess why that happened. Why did the Iroquois, further east of the Huron, need now, suddenly at this point in history, to move west? They were being pushed west. So the Iroquois turned west, committed to driving out the Huron. And because of their organization, they they can launch an all-out concerted attack in one great sweep. And the Hurons, instead of all coming together to fight the leading edge of the attack, run to their own separate palisades, their own separate places, and are picked off one by one and destroyed. And they flee, and they flee without enough provisions, so that the food, the more they're chased, the more they flee, the more overpopulated each place is, the less their provision. And of course, winter comes. The Huron are chased out. They end up on an island, just the remnant. And then they realize that this island is a death trap, right? So they just sort of slip, they just totally break up and go in every direction, just trying to stay alive. So that the Huron people ended up in Canada. There's a whole paragraph in here of where they went, but they went to Canada and they went out in sort of all directions, and they were subsumed in other stronger groups and virtually disappeared. Virtually, to all intents and purposes, are destroyed. And this is a process of, oh man, I just can't even think how few years it is from the beginning of this story to the end of it. Just incredible. Incredible story.
So you say absorbed within other groups. And do we know, is there a current name that would identify those people?
Well, it says here, and I'll just give you the last two paragraphs. So the land of the Hurons became a no man's land, its people scattered in every direction. The tobacco tribe, the Petun, absorbed some of the homeless wanderers, while ironically the Seneca adopted others, which are some of the Iroquois Confederacy, who then lived amicably with their former enemies. Additional Huron units moved further west, settling on Shawnee and Ojibwe lands in Ohio and Michigan. And when later Yankee frontiersmen met them, they were called the Wyandots, which were actually dealing with isolated fragments of the once proud Wendat Confederacy. And remember, the Wendat are the Hurons. Okay. The Christian Hurons remained with their Jesuit leaders, and not surprisingly, converts increased rapidly as their Indian culture declined from demoralization to total disintegration. Between March and August of 1649, and I wonder exactly what year it was that they first came in. Let me see. 1649, 1534, less than 100 years this story lasts. The Jesuits baptized more than 14,000 people, no, 1,400 people. During the next 7 months, another 1,600 received the sacrament, most of them after moving to this island. It's called Gahodendo, can't say it. We do not know how much the Jesuits relaxed their probationary rules about testing a convert's interest in religion. In other words, in the beginning, it was hard to be baptized and be converted. You had to demonstrate quite a bit. And then we get these numbers increasing, and they wonder, well, maybe it wasn't easier to get baptized. It's possible that they offered the rite to everyone as a consolation for the dangers that were continually threatening them. You know, that in 100 years, look at what happened to these people. The Jesuits became a lot more compassionate, turned around and baptized people. By the summer of 1650, their spiritual mentors invited surviving Christian Indians to move north and settle in the protected St. Lawrence Valley. And that's where some of them are. Over several decades, they found temporary placement around Quebec and Sillery and on the, I don't speak French, Ile de Orleans, I can't. The strongest Huron town was Junet Lorette, founded in 1697. And here, these are the Christian Hurons. They sustained their chosen faith with essentially pre-contact lifestyle and subsistence. Because the Jesuits basically left, and so then they were Christian, they settled, and they kind of picked up some of their past. Descendants of that community have survived to the present, but their assimilation of technological culture now evinces a way of living far removed from the independent Huron civilization. The Iroquois victory and the Huron diaspora is what they say, and I think that means sort of total defeat or disappearance.
Scattering,
yeah. Prevent us from knowing what might have been achieved in the free Christian state that the Jesuits originally envisioned.
I know there's a Wyandotte County in Kansas, and I wonder if, I don't know what the history of Huron, South Dakota is, but I wonder if that's from a group that came there.
Yeah, and I think. Yes, it's true that the Huron did exist in isolated places and continue to this day. So we have been riding on an eagle's back over the Great Lakes, and we've been seeing Indian as a people with very specific names and a very unique history that is ongoing. I was working on the 17th century in this story. And the next time we'll be moving further east, the Northeast Indians, and those people as they interacted with the English missionaries that came to that area. And that will be the Massachusetts. Some information about the Nipmucks, the Wampanoags, the Narragansetts, the Pequots, and the Mohicans. And that's for next time.
What you said about people protecting the burial sites of ancient burial sites and so forth. That same thing is an issue in Israel now with the Orthodox Jewish leaders being concerned about archaeology digs in burial places and not wanting to dig up the, and this is, you know, very ancient.
And there's a corollary issue in that museums all over the United States are filled with artifacts that were dug out of Indian grave sites. And in my opinion, a real move of justice and compassion and advocacy would be to return sacred objects and anything dug up out of the ground. For most Indian people is sacred, return them to the original peoples. That the ownership is, frankly, I think. Well, I don't know. I don't know. You know, if the people are ready to protect them and preserve them, I personally think, it's just my own personal opinion, that is sometimes, in some cases, the only heritage, the only inheritance that remains, and it should be returned to the people. And that, again, is just my personal opinion.
It's sort of like the, I read recently that there was a painting in England, an Italian painting, that had been there for many years in England, and was sold in auction in London the last few months ago for several $100,000 by an American. And the English were very concerned about this, that this painting was going to leave England. And they were trying to get some money together to buy it back so that it wouldn't leave England. But I kept thinking to myself, well, this is an Italian painting. No concern. If they want to really be concerned about returning it to its heritage, they ought to send it back to Italy.
Yeah.
How did they get it? And there's all, you look through all the museums of England and you'll find things that were looted from temples in Greece and Egypt and Babylon and all these things that they consider their property now. Egypt and Greece have been asking for those things back for years. And they will send them.
Well, and this brings up a move that I would bring us back to the spiral dance of in some ways it's really hard for me to do this work, because I'm having to tell other people's stories. And I just lift this up to you that what we have done is only dance through. And, you know, next time you come around to the Huron, you know, I would invite you to dream about hearing the story from their own mouth, you know, from the mouths of the teachers of the those who remain in the Huron. It's very scary to be a storyteller of somebody else's story. It's like, if I told the story of your life, it would be one thing. It would be so different if we could hear your story from your own words. It's a little bit like an unauthorized biography. And so I do this with real fear and trembling and trepidation to tell the story.